President Trump has reiterated that Tomahawk missiles may be needed to force President Putin into peace on terms beneficial to or preferred by the Kiev leaders in Volodymyr Zelensky. Doesn't seem to be paying much attention to what the Russians are saying to that, but then that might be kind of par for the course. And then we have, of course, Volodymyr Zelensky really eager to get those Tomahawks, and he's coming to town later this week here in Washington, D.C. to try to talk about this and get some of the ramifications of what this may or may not mean. We have back with us the ever-popular Colonel Douglas McGregor, defense and foreign policy analyst, former advisor to the Secretary of Defense, and highly decorated combat veteran. Doug, welcome back to the show.
Hey, happy to be here.
Well, listen, we got a lot of things to talk about today, not the least of which is this Tomahawk thing, which at first I kind of thought that this was just going to be kind of a throwaway line. They brought the subject up, but I thought, well, it's going to go away. But it's kind of grown some legs and it keeps going on. One of the reasons is because Donald Trump himself has given it life.
Do they want to have Tomahawks going in their direction? I don't think so. I think I might speak to Russia about that, in all fairness. I told that to President Zelensky, because Tomahawks are a new step of aggression. Right? You understand that very well.
Are
okay?
You saying that you will speak to Putin first about
then
Tomahawks?
I might talk to him. I might say, look, if this war's not going to get settled, I'm going to send them Tomahawks. I may say that. The Tomahawk is an incredible weapon, very offensive weapon. And honestly, Russia does not need that. They don't need that. Yeah, I might tell them that if the war is not settled, that we may very well do it. We may not, but we may do it. I think it's appropriate to bring up, yeah.
What do you think about that, Doug? Is that going to make the war get settled or make the war expanded?
I don't know what he thinks the Tomahawk is. It's obviously not a strategic game changer in the context of warfare. It's an old system. Now it has use. It's still effective in many ways. The biggest problem with the Tomahawk is it reaches out a little further than 1,000 miles, carries a warhead of 3,300 pounds. There's the air-launched, sea-launched, and ground-launched version. Now, the air-launched and sea-launched versions of the Tomahawk are probably out of consideration. The Ukrainians can't use it in that capacity unless we want to put our own pilots and our own ships at risk, which I don't think he's prepared to do. That means you get the ground-launched version. The ground-launched version is very unique. It's almost a boutique weapon, because of the modifications to the warhead and to the missile that had to be made for the U.S. Army. That is problematic. Now, there is a version of that missile that can go into a 40-foot container so that it looks like a missile in a box. That could be mounted on a barge and then fired from the barge on one of the rivers very easily. Perhaps that's something they'll do. I don't know. But in any case, whatever you do on land with this thing means mission planning and execution lies entirely in U.S. hands. So if you use this, the Russians are going to regard this as a direct, unambiguous act of war against them by Washington. And I don't think President Trump has thought that one through yet. Now, how many of them are out there that they could use? To be frank with you, I don't know. They're hard to make. They take time to make. But you would have to have several. I don't know how many we've got. I really don't. So, you know, with President Trump, I don't know who briefs him. I don't know who keeps him informed. But he tends to characterize things in ways that are just not necessarily wrong, but misleading and sometimes dangerous. In this case, he's overestimating the missile and he's simultaneously underestimating the probable Russian response. That's the issue here with the damn Tomahawk. By the way, you could shoot them down. Russian integrated air defenses would probably, if you launched 50 of them, I suspect that the Russian integrated air defenses would get most of them, but not all of them, because you can't build an air and missile defense system that will take everything out. I mean, we know that from experience. So something will get through. Then the question is targeting. And he said at some point last week, well, I'd like to know where they're going to shoot these and how they plan to use them. Well, he doesn't understand that all that's going to be determined on by the U.S. personnel that man the system. So we'll know exactly where they're going. That's the problem. If these things are launched into an area where you have a Russian population on the outskirts of Ryazan or Belgrade or St. Petersburg or something, you're going to end up at war with Russia. That's the big problem. I don't think he gets that.
Well, he didn't. He doesn't appear to, because up to this point, he's been talking about. Well, he used to talk about rather getting the war over and bringing peace, et cetera. And then he's kind of just abandoned that. Now he's just talking about forcing Russia into terms that Ukraine wants. And I just really have a hard time understanding even the categorically why he would think that when all of his previous efforts to bring the two sides together didn't work, that now he can just say, all right, you know what? You just do what we say, or we're going to get this missile, which I guess he thinks is going to scare Russia. But what do you make of that change from where Trump came in through the first 2 or 3 months to where he is now?
I think he's made the transformation into Biden, too. I think he's been listening to the likes of Keith Kellogg. And Kellogg, and for that matter, on Fox News, Keen and others are saying, oh, the Russians are a paper tiger. The Russians really aren't that good. The Russians are hard-pressed to deal with Ukraine. The Russians can't sustain themselves. I mean, just go on and on and on. That's not true, frankly, but if you believe that, it tends to lead you to the erroneous conclusion that you will suddenly achieve something with bullying tactics that thus far have failed. It's sort of like the meeting in Anchorage. I think Trump genuinely believed that if he put on this big show up in Anchorage and gave President Putin the big welcome, that they would all troop into a room and President Putin, who after all has forces that aren't that good anyway, will say, okay, you know, let's have a ceasefire. Well, that didn't happen, did it? It didn't happen because we went in there without studying any of the Russian positions. We didn't move in there with a counterproposal that made any sense that we had carefully constructed. It was all nonsense. It was glamour and glitter. This is the Trump trademark. He wants to be George C. Scott standing in front of the big flag, beating his chest and pretending that he's commanding vast armies to move on a moment's notice. That's what he likes. That's what we're seeing now in Sharm el-Sheikh and what we saw in Israel. Optics, optics, optics. You know, somebody used to say on a commercial, where's the beef? Well, the beef takes a lot of work. The beef takes a lot of study. Diplomacy is tough. So it's easier to bully, especially if you think your opponent's not going to respond. That's very dangerous because the Russians have said, this is a major escalation. You know, at some point, the Russians tell themselves they're not going to listen to us. They're not going to respond until we demonstrate exactly how we feel and what we can do. You know, I think the Russians could pick targets. Every U.S. base or NATO airport or airfield from Lithuania to Romania, and they could attack all of them within a few hours and obliterate them. And perhaps in their minds, they're reaching the conclusion that that's what they have to do in order to get our attention. I don't think we're prepared for that, but I think it's a very real possibility.
And you see that Gary's showing this headline right now, this fresh here, U.S. to provide Ukraine with only 20 to 50 Tomahawk missiles, according to the Financial Times. And that is on the heels, or rather on the front of Volodymyr Zelensky earlier today talking about how he's eager to come talk to Trump in person.
The main topic is air defense. And also I will have, by the way, I will have a meeting with energy companies. I needed, that was a proposition from President, and yes, and I will have meeting with some companies because there are some needs what we need now because of different format of attacks, even not those attacks which Russia already did, Yes, but we have to prepare in any case. So it will be helpful. And so the main topics are air defense and our possibilities with long range to pressure on Russia.
So there he's again, he said it there at the end, the long range, which only means the Tomahawk missiles right now, because they've already had some of the other ones, which had negligible, if any, actual impact on the course of the war. Even, I don't know if you could just kind of talk about militarily, maybe at the operational level, forget about what Russia may do for the moment. I want to hit that separately. But what do you think is the best case scenario from either the U.S. or Ukraine perspective that these missiles could actually accomplish in terms of the Russia's warfighting capacity?
20 to 50, I think you could do damage to some of the power grid. You know, they're gonna want targets that obviously don't move, don't reposition. So that means airfields, something on the scale of what was done with the unmanned systems against the Russian bombers. I think that sort of thing is what they're going to look for. They've already tried to damage the energy grid in Russia, the refineries, and so it hasn't had any significant effect at all, contrary to what people think. But I suspect those are the kinds of targets that they'll want to strike, because those are easier to identify. But again, it all has to be mission planning and execution by U.S. forces. That is, either they're from the United States Army or they are contractors that work for the defense industries, Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, so forth, that produce the missiles, the guidance systems, and the radars. So from the Russian standpoint, it doesn't make any difference who does it. I mean, as far as they're concerned, it's American. We are attacking Russia. But I think that's about it. What else can you do? I mean, do you want to try a long shot and hit the Kremlin and in the hopes you kill somebody? Remember, you've got to move these things into Ukraine, okay, for any plausible deniability. You must go into Ukraine. That means that you're already at risk, because as soon as you cross the border into Ukraine, you're going to have a very difficult time evading persistent surveillance by the Russians. Then you've got to set up somewhere inside Ukraine that puts you within range of the kinds of targets that I just mentioned. So you can probably do it from Western Ukraine. In other words, you don't have to cross the Dnieper River, but you'll probably want to move 300 kilometers closer to Kiev and the Dnieper River. All of those things are hazardous. The Russians are not stupid. They have good technology in space. They're going to be on the lookout for it. And their goal, as soon as they see any evidence for this, is to respond instantaneously. In other words, don't wait to respond, but initiate action. That's why I think if you're going to use a system, probably the best solution would be the rocket in a box, because then you at least have a 40-foot container, and you can put other 40-foot containers out there as decoys. If you're just putting it on the back of a truck, that's very easy to identify. And it'll be problematic. But 20 to 50, again, that's not going to change the war, but it could precipitate a major war with Russia.
Well, and to that effect, that's exactly what Dmitry Medvedev has warned about here a couple of days ago on his Telegram channel, where he said, listen, one of the problems with this is that if Trump, this is what he wrote, Trump said that if the president of Russia doesn't resolve the Ukrainian conflict, quote, it's not going to be good for him. So just another one of his endless threats. If the business peacemaker is talking about Tomahawks, then that statement is wrong. The delivery of those missiles would not be good for anyone. First and foremost, it will end badly for Trump himself. It has already been said 100 times in terms of even Star-Spangled Uncle Sam could understand. It is impossible for us to tell whether a Tomahawk carries a nuclear or conventional warhead while it's in flight. Their launch wouldn't originate from the bandar at Kiev, so it would be controlled by the United States. In other words, by Trump. So how is Russia supposed to respond? Exactly. Now, that rhetorical question, which he left unanswered, but assumed that people knew, but that seems kind of like what you're talking about.
Well, the Russians have said that they reserve the right to respond to such a deep attack with the use of a nuclear weapon. That's very clear. And so he's raised the right issue. How are we supposed to know whether it is nuclear or non-nuclear? Now, I suppose that Trump can announce that we under no circumstances will use nuclear weapons or initiate the use of nuclear weapons. That would make sense. That would be an intelligent thing for him to do. But I'm sure the same people that are advising him to do this stupid thing to begin with will also advise him not to do that. So Medvedev, if you look at Medvedev and Putin, you're familiar with the concept of the ego, the id, and the superego from Freud. Well, Medvedev is the id. In other words, he blurts out things that other people think, I'm sure, things that President Putin considers, but it's not likely to say because he's a very judicious person. He exercises tremendous restraint. He understands his words will be taken very seriously, so he wants to be as precise as he can with the meaning. Mr. Medvedev is less in that department. He's much more likely to say, damn it, you know, we need to blast these people from here to kingdom come because that's the only thing they'll understand. So what you get from President Trump is a much more measured response. That doesn't, you know, he's more the superego. But that doesn't mean that you should ignore Medvedev, because Medvedev probably expresses the rage that is felt by Russians in Russia more accurately than almost anybody else. I mean, the population of that country is furious. But once again, I don't think either President Putin or President Trump want a nuclear confrontation. But you have this unfortunate condition in Washington right now that President Trump is not surrounded by people who are measured, thoughtful, considerate. These people are basically urging war with Russia. Can't hear you.
Dan, turn your mic on. Well,
sorry about that. Yeah, yeah, I want to go down a path you went to a second ago where you said that basically Medvedev is kind of the ids of what people are thinking but not saying. We actually had one of our viewers here who I think is complimentary to the Russian side. He says, President Putin is respected but is criticized in Russia for doing the rational thing and not wanting World War III, but eventually he's going to have to do what people say. I think what he's referring to there is something that we had Gilbert Doctorow on the show a few days back, to where he said that there's lots of people angry in Russia at Putin, not for the conduct of the war, but because he's not going in heavier. And I just wonder what your thoughts are on the potential pressure against Putin inside that he's not going hard enough. And could this be the trigger where he finally says, all right, I'm going to have to do something pretty harsh?
Well, it's not just his population. It's also his inner circle. He's got plenty of people in his inner circle that would like to go much harder against us. Again, this is why I do not expect that President Putin would authorize the use of a nuclear weapon in response to a Tomahawk strike. But what I would expect is something along the lines that I discussed earlier. Why put up with any NATO installation within range? Why put up with U.S. forces essentially planning and executing these missions with these missiles? So he's got a lot of targets to choose from, ranging from Lithuania all the way down to Romania. And I think it would be a terrible mistake. In fact, I think it is a terrible mistake to underestimate his ability to do that. Once it happens, then the same people that have been pushing you over the line to escalate are going to march in and say, it's time for us to nuke these people, which is insane, sheer insanity. That's the path to the war that no one wins and the whole world loses.
And what do you say to those critics that say, oh, well, Putin would never do that because he knows Article 5, 32 members of alliance. He's not going to go. He's just within one right now on the ground. But if he does that, he's got everybody. What do you say to those arguments?
No, not at all. In fact, if anything, large numbers of people in Europe and many states would be horrified by the whole thing, and they would not support it. I think there are assumptions about NATO that are just fundamentally false and misleading. This is not some sort of cohesive alliance. This is a very, this is like herding cats. And you have a few cats that are very loud and are bullies. The rest of the herd is not so interested. And then some of the cats have said, fine, do it on your own. I'm staying at home. So Slovakia, Czechia, Hungary, they're not going to participate in this. And even though the Poles have a very fine army, they also have a very fine economy right now. They've come a long way in a short period of time. Push comes to shove, I don't see the Poles joining this effort either. They may not like the Russians, but they're not suicidal. So it boils down to Germany, France, and Great Britain. And again, I think President Putin is watching carefully what happens in those countries. I mean, I'm sure you've seen the unrest that exists in these countries, particularly in France and Britain. You've seen the demonstrations more recently in Germany, demonstrations against arms and munition manufacturers. There is no appetite for this war that the globalist elites keep talking about. I don't care what the current Minister of Defense says in Germany. He's holding a dialogue of the deaf with the population. Population doesn't want to mobilize and march east in this great war with Russia. It's just there.
As it turns out, Doug, it's not just the Minister of Defense, but also the chief of the BND, the intel services in Germany, who just released this.
Wir müssen uns auf weitere Lageverschärfung vorbereiten. Das Handeln Russlands ist darauf angelegt, die NATO zu unterminieren, europäische Demokratien zu destabilisieren, unsere Gesellschaften zu spalten und einzuschüchtern. So rechnet man sich in Moskau realistische Chancen aus, die eigene Einflusszone nach Westen auszuweiten und das wirtschaftlich vielfach überlegene Europa in die Abhängigkeit von Russland zu bringen. Um dieses Ziel zu erreichen, wird Russland, wenn nötig, auch eine direkte militärische Auseinandersetzung mit der NATO nicht scheuen. Nachgiebigkeit wird uns von Gegnern wie Russland als Schwäche ausgelegt. Daraus müssen wir die richtigen Schlüsse ziehen. Wir dürfen uns nicht zurücklehnen in der Annahme, ein möglicher russischer Angriff käme frühestens 2029. Wir stehen schon heute im Feuer.
So, just to summarize, if anybody couldn't read all that, so Russia undermines NATO, Russia undermines democracy in the West. They will not hesitate to use direct action against NATO. And we have to draw the right lessons that weakness is seen as leniency is seen as weakness. And we can't wait till 2029 because we are under fire now. How is that message going to be received either in Europe or in Germany specifically?
Well, first of all, there's nothing new in anything he said. These kinds of comments have been made repeatedly over the last 3 years. However, let's be frank. The only people putting democracy at risk in Germany right now are the people in the government who want to ban the alternative for Germany, who appear to be implicated in helping to poison or murder opposition politicians. I mean, this is a very serious matter in Germany right now. I mean, we all know that Google adjusts algorithms to suppress people like us. That's not a secret. Everybody gets that. But this is far more serious. This is outright censorship. And their talk about banning the existence of the alternative for Germany, which is rapidly approaching a third or more of the population in terms of support, is outrageous. It's the antithesis of anything you would remotely characterize as democratic. As far as the rest of it is concerned, it's just nonsense. Why has Russia stayed where it is, east of the Dnieper River, for the last 3 years? For the reason that President Putin does not want to give NATO an excuse to attack Russia. In other words, the United States leading NATO. That's why they're there. I mean, they could have crossed this river a long time ago. And then the stupid remark that you get from the likes of Kellogg is, well, why haven't they done that yet? Because they're not stupid like you, General. They're trying to avoid a general war. I mean, I can't think of any leader in the last 50 years that has worked as tirelessly and as hard as President Putin has to avoid a war in Europe. I mean, he really, really has. We're the ones that pushed the envelope in the 90s in the Balkans. Then we tried to drag all the NATO members into our wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya. He hasn't done these things. We have. Russia is not interested in a general war. But, you know, these kinds of statements that are entirely misleading and frankly deceitful make it much harder for the Russians to do business with us. And I don't know where we go from here. My great concern is not so much the people running Germany. It's who's running the show here in Washington. That's what worries me, because whatever we do, they will follow. And that's why it's in President Trump's interest, in the interest of humanity, for him to step forward and say enough's enough. Instead, he likes to play the role of the great father who is sorting the children out that just don't understand, and threatening this man, Putin, who just doesn't understand. He must end this war, you know, as though no one else has a role in ending anything. It's depressing. And so you get people like Zelensky, who are well-funded by all the wrong people and represent, a disastrous future for Ukraine and Europe.
And, you know, you say that Putin has done everything he can to try and prevent war, but he also is, as you mentioned a second ago, coming under a lot of pressure, even on his inner circle, as well as some of his population. And I think that he kind of implied or gave a shout out, I guess, to that pressure, that he is aware of it and that there are some limits to where he can go and how much restraint he can show. He was asked at a recent interview, I think it was a couple of days ago, the interviewer said, there is a report out that the United States or some other country may conduct a nuclear weapons test. And what would you do if that happened? Here's what he said.
I said that in some countries, preparations are being made for testing, but this is also well known to specialists, because there is always a temptation to check the effectiveness of that combat fuel, which has been stored in missiles for many, many years. All this is simulated on computers. Specialists believe that this is sufficient, but some of these specialists think that it would be necessary to conduct real-life tests. And in some countries, as far as we know, they are considering this and even preparing for it. So I said that if they conduct tests, we will do the same. Is this good or bad? From the point of view of ensuring security, it is good. From the point of view of the overall picture related to deterrence, to actions aimed, if not at reducing, then at restraining the arms race, it is probably not bad.
So he's focused there on deterrence, but he seems to be saying, hey, if you test, we'll test. But if the weapons are needed to be used, we can go down that path too. How do you interpret his comments there?
Well, first of all, he spoke like someone who knows his profession. He spoke like someone who understands national defense strategy, as someone who understands the nature of nuclear weapons. Launch reliability is a huge issue. I mean, how many TOW missiles did we fire in 1991 that simply blew up after they left the tube or grounded out? A surprising number. And in most cases, these were not really old TOW missiles.
Yeah.
They simply did not work properly. And what he's talking about is an understanding that there is something to be said for testing. Now, he talked about the fuel in the missiles. A couple of years ago, the Chinese made inspections of their missile batteries that are on the coast, and they discovered that, surprise, surprise, there was no fuel in the rockets. It had been removed and sold on the black market. Well, that's China that has an enormous problem with corruption. But my point is, there is a rationale for testing, as he points out. And it may be useful, as he suggested, in the context of deterrence, because people will discover that perhaps it doesn't all work as advertised, or they will discover that it's intact. In any case, a mix will emerge, and that will have an impact on future arms limitation talks. This man is not talking about going to war with anyone. He's made that very clear. He's explaining what goes on in the minds of people that have to deal with nuclear weapons at the highest levels. It's very refreshing. I cannot imagine any scenario in which anybody I dealt with in the White House or on the Hill could stand up and be as eloquent, articulate, and directly accurate as President Putin is. That's frightening, but I think that's where we are.
Well, there's another one that probably would not fit in that category, who, after Putin had made those comments, didn't seem to get the deterrent message. And in fact, they seem to be going down the path of thinking that this is just bluff on Putin. And that is Foreign Policy Chief Kaya Kallas.
Ukraine's defense is European defense, so that's why we are also working on next packages to help you with the military needs. When it comes to also politically supporting you, then we are working on the 19th package of sanctions to put more pressure on Russia to really end this war. Russia's economy is already weak. We are making it weaker by our sanctions.
So no thought whatsoever to slowing down or backing down on anything. The only thing the European Union, NATO, Western Europe, Ukraine, and apparently the White House are thinking is more war support, not even looking at the possibility of that. How do you interpret that?
I think she's reading from the talking points that were sent to her by von der Leyen. And if you listen to either of these women, you know, if you can stomach it for any length of time, you walk away and throw up your hands in disgust. These people don't know what they're talking about. They don't know what they're doing. They are just repeating utterly false talking points. These are narratives crafted in London and in McLean by the CIA and MI6. That's what it is. That's all there is to it. If you're looking for someone who should be held responsible for this sort of thing, I think Ratcliffe and the CIA is a good candidate. And he appears to be the ultimate instrument of these narratives as well. It's dangerous, but I don't see any evidence that President Trump has the foundation of experience, knowledge, and understanding to challenge it. And so he repeats it. But he needs to re-examine the wisdom of doing so, because he could find himself in the most unenviable position of any president in the history of this country, of precipitating a war with a country that is not our enemy, that does not want war, and a war that could rapidly spread to a global level and bring in at least half the world, plus China, maybe even India, on the side of Russia against us. I don't see how the world benefits from it. I don't see how we benefit from it. So we have to abandon these outrageous demands and extreme goals. I mean, if you listen carefully to everyone, the only solution to this crisis in Ukraine is for the Russians to wake up tomorrow morning, disarm, beg forgiveness, and all run in formation back to Russia. That's not going to happen. And that is the expectation, all based on this utter nonsense that Russia is weak, Russia is backward, Russia's suffering, Russia's this, Russia's that. Talk to the people that have recently been in Russia. They'll come back and tell you that's complete and utter nonsense.
And if anyone has been paying attention on the front line, the problem is, I think that the Kaya Kallases, the Ursula von der Leyens, the Keir Starmers, they think that time is unlimited, that they can just keep rolling this year after year and just keep the war going on, keep harming Russia in their, as they imagine things. But there's a problem with that, and that is it matters what happens on the front line. And right now, there's a couple of key areas on the Eastern Front that are on the verge of collapsing, and that is in the Pokrovsk area, and that is in the Kupiansk area. Russia had been going this slow grind for a while, but they now have about half of each of those cities are in danger of taking all of both of them in the near term. At the same time, and this is a big issue, news out of the Ukrainian media just this morning is talking about that the law enforcement officials have revealed open source that almost 290,000 cases of CZCH, that's basically AWOL in U.S. parlance, were desertions from the full-scale war. And according to the article, in response to Ukraine's inquiry, the prosecutor general reported that from January 2022 to September 25, 235,000 criminal proceedings were registered under this AWOL situation, 53,000 for desertions. And as for comparisons from 2022 to September 24, so a year ago, law enforcement had only had about 60,000. So that shows you that, almost 100, over 150,000 in just the last year alone, and these things continue on. When I did some further reading on some of the from the Ukrainska Pravda, they explained some of the reasons why. And they say that the motivation is just going through the tank, because it says many of the surviving members of the Ukraine professional military that have been serving, some of which since 2022, never have gotten a release. They have never gotten to go home. And so they said mentally they're just out. So they said the only thing they have is to desert. And they're just tired of fighting and dying on a war that they realize they can't win. At some point, Doug, I would imagine this is going to reach some kind of critical mass. When you add in there the huge losses on top of all this, I just don't know how you keep sustaining this forever.
Well, as long as you can rely on the United States to provide you with a support package that includes mission planning and execution personnel, and they will launch Tomahawk missiles for you to maintain the fiction that you, as a viable state, are still alive and that you have some warfighting capacity, I guess it can go on. That's the problem. In other words, everything is a facade. You know, we were talking earlier about President Trump's passion for optics. Well, optics seem to determine a great deal in Western Europe. And all of this is because the pain and suffering that you're describing doesn't strike Europe or the United States. No one is feeling any pain. So when somebody says, well, let's give them Tomahawks, that'll teach them a lesson. And you think that you're the greatest power on earth and that you're fighting a substandard force, a backward military establishment, I guess that's okay. In other words, what you're talking about is reality, but how much reality creeps into the discussion in the West? You just had Kallas on. We've listened to von der Leyen. We've listened to the defense minister in Germany. These people have lost their minds. They're completely out of touch with reality. They have no idea what they're talking about. They don't understand the destructive capacity of modern weapons. They don't understand that this war that they've been watching at a distance could suddenly close that distance very rapidly with them. And I don't know why this doesn't sink in, except that there's no background. There's no experience. That's the only thing I can think of. Because if you talk to anybody, American, British, or German, or Soviet, or Russian, who's fought in the Second World War, they'd be horrified at these kinds of remarks because they lived it. They saw it. But that's not what we're dealing with. We're dealing with the sort of freshman class of the new age, where war is a push-button exercise. And there are very few casualties. And if there are casualties, they occur on somebody else's soil.
Yeah, somebody else's troops. Well, I mean, we'll just have to wait and see on this, because at some point, something's got to give, because this literally can't go on forever. Something we'll have to give somewhere. And I just pray to God we don't find out that there is an expansion of this war and an escalation beyond the borders of Ukraine, because then all bets are off and all kinds of bad things could happen after that. Now, I want to shift gears here in the remainder of the time that we have with you today to the Middle East, because obviously a lot of people are talking a whole bunch about that, that peace has come to the Middle East, that the Gaza, Israel war, at least for the moment, the guns have gone silent, mostly, although there has been some deaths in the northern part of the Gaza Strip here overnight, but largely it's holding. But President Trump, you mentioned a second ago, I was thinking about this as you were saying it. He loves the optics. He loves all the imagery and whatever. And boy, was that on display yesterday, both in Israel at the Knesset and then at Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt. It was all about that pageantry and pomp and circumstance, et cetera. A couple of problems I have with that, like your view on that. First of all, Trump, in his description of what happened, said, this is final peace.
This is the day that people across the region and around the world have been working, striving, hoping, and praying for. Together, we've achieved what everybody said was impossible. At long last, we have peace in the Middle East. And it's a very simple expression, peace in the Middle East. And we've heard it for many years, but nobody thought it could ever get there. And now we're there.
Now we're there. See, that's a real problem to me, because all they have done so far is have a ceasefire and a hostage exchange. That's it. Phase one. Phase two hasn't even been negotiated yet. So there is tons of potential landmines, et cetera, and all kinds of problems, even inside the Israeli government itself, in terms of what it's even going to agree to. What do you make of this claim that peace in the Middle East has been achieved?
Well, you know that President Trump never exaggerates. This is a very restrained individual. He's very modest in his speech. Look, this is another great moment that President Trump's donors or handlers, whatever you want to call them, have given to him. I don't think this is necessarily something that the Israelis, especially Netanyahu and his government, really wanted. But they saw virtue in a pause, however long that may be. I can't estimate it at this stage. And they gave him this big win in his mind. I don't think he understands that. I'm not sure most Americans are paying quite as much attention to all of this as he thinks. But his donors have said, okay, go ahead and do this. However, we know that the goals and objectives of the Israeli state leadership have not changed. They are as committed to the destruction of Iran, the Balkanization of Iran, and the rest of the region as they were before. There's no change in that. What they do need right now is a respite. Their soldiers are really, really tired. Many of the reservists don't show up for duty. They've had a lot of senior officers that have warned against any more killing. And of course, they've lost a lot of people that they won't admit to losing, because to admit that they've lost anybody in any great numbers or that they've had many casualties at all would be an admission of weakness. And that's an impossibility for the Israelis. They're not going to do that, because that, in their minds, would give aid and comfort to their opponents in the region. We also know that they have weaponized probably ISIS fighters, people operating in Syria and elsewhere, to come into Gaza to keep the pressure on Hamas. And I think at some point we will see more fighting inside Gaza. It will be blamed on the Palestinians, who, after all, are a barbarous people that cannot govern themselves. And therefore, the Israelis must go back in order to restore order. I think these kinds of things are in the future. It's planned. But for the moment, even though it is very hard to implement a ceasefire in the aftermath of genocidal warfare, as we just saw within the last 24 hours where five Palestinians were killed, they will do some of it. And when it's no longer in their interest to continue, they will stop. But this also creates an opportunity to focus instead now on Iran and preparing for that inevitable conflict. And I think that's what they'll do to the extent that they're able. They'll focus in that direction.
Now, speaking of Iran, one of the other things about President Trump's comments after his Knesset speech yesterday, which got my ears perked up a little bit in a negative way, is Trump's apparent belief that it was the reason why he was able to get the ceasefire and compel Israel to at least ceasefire for the time and got Hamas to agree was because he used military force against Iran. Watch this.
When did you know that Hamas was going to release the hostages?
Well, I'll tell you, I think it really started when we took out the nuclear capability of Iran. When you look at what they had, you couldn't have made this deal if somebody's sitting over there with a nuclear weapon over your head. And I think when we did that, and there were other obviously very warlike things that we did over the course of 4 or 5 years, if you setting the table.
Yeah, see, he's talking about setting the table. I'm sure he's going all the way back to Soleimani assassination and all the other things that we've done, et cetera, maybe hitting in the Houthis. But he seems to believe that all of these military actions brought peace here. And then he's talking about, you couldn't have done this with a nuclear weapon hanging over your head. There was no nuclear weapon. There is no nuclear weapon. And there wasn't before the strike either. So that's not even actually a real thing. But do you have any concerns that Trump seems to believe that it was the use of military power which brought peace, and might he use that in other areas?
Well, that's his preferred rationalization, and that also justifies his preference for the use of military power versus diplomacy. Remember, diplomacy takes time. It requires great effort, study, lengthy discussions, and flexibility in thinking and behavior. Those are not the hallmarks of Trump policy. Trump likes to impose his will. That's his nature. Now, having said that, remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. After that was settled and the world breathed a huge sigh of relief, at least we did in the United States, there was this notion that we had effectively won over the Soviets. In other words, the Soviets were embarrassed. They had to withdraw. They were humiliated. And this was, quote unquote, a win for the United States. That is not necessarily, by the way, how JFK viewed it. JFK was very sober-minded about the whole experience and was committed to finding a way to avoid anything like that again in the future. But there were a lot of people in Washington that chose that interpretation. But what actually happened? What happened is the Soviets invested very heavily in dramatically expanding their nuclear arsenal and the missiles that could deliver them. So that by 1972, the Russians had achieved parity with us and then some. They were well on their way to nuclear supremacy. In other words, the lesson that people talked about along the lines of the conditions of causation that you were relating, they didn't learn the lesson that many people thought they had. They learned a different lesson. We're not going to go into anything in the future unless we know we've got at least as much and preferably more than the opponent, because then they can't ignore us. They can't dismiss us. That is where Iran is now. Iran is building up and growing stronger with each passing week. The Russians are doing something very similar. The Chinese are not far behind, because the lessons that we are imparting to them is that the only thing we respect is the use of force. That's the problem. We aren't approachable. You cannot conduct normal diplomatic relations with the United States. The United States only understands the use of force. What a catastrophe for the American people.
And let's, to the extent that you can, kind of project forward, say, I don't know, 2, 3, maybe 5 years. What do you expect to be going on behind the scenes with the Iranians, and how much more difficult might that make a future attempt, whether by Israel or by Israel and the United States, to again bomb their nuclear facilities?
I don't think Israel will allow us to wait that long, because they're not stupid. They have good intelligence, and they know that what I'm saying is accurate. So the probability of getting more than a few months before we see another collision is very low. They know they're in a position now where if they can't strike and they can't persuade us or drag us into the fight with them, they could lose. So the longer you wait, the stronger your opponent gets, but you don't necessarily reach that level of military supremacy that you had in the past. Just as we could not achieve that after the Cuban Missile Crisis. So we ended up with parity. Now, we had different goals than the Israelis do. But for the Israelis, it boils down to a win or die proposition in their minds. That's the way they see it. So, again, that's why I think, and I don't doubt that probably President Trump believes what he says. But I don't think we're going to get very far before we have another collision with Iran. I just don't know when it will occur. Have we bought some additional time? Maybe. But, you know, time is not working in our favor in Ukraine. Time is not working in our favor in the Middle East. And time is certainly not working in our favor in Asia. The Chinese are not sitting idly by. They're building and expanding their capabilities, because everybody believes it's the only thing that we pay attention to. We only respect the use of force.
And if I could just ask in the final segment here, and staying on that theme of the use of force, what do you make of these building up of combat power in the our own hemisphere around Venezuela, and the more and more conversations about going after the Maduro regime? What do you think of that?
Well, obviously, I think it's a bad idea, because I don't think that Venezuela is a large and powerful state in military terms. It's very large. It's about the size of Germany and France and Switzerland together. It's huge. They've got almost 30 million people. Their armed forces are respectable for the global South, but they're not going to present much of a challenge for us. On the other hand, they've also got 600,000 militia inside the country. And rather than impale themselves on us, they could certainly provide the foundation for an insurgency against any lingering U.S. military presence in that country. And I think what's even more dangerous in my judgment is that they will become this rallying point for Latin America against us. You know, we're not exactly popular in that part of the world, never have been. That part of the world has always been jealous and envious of us. After all, we were the evil white Yankee Protestants, and they were the Latino Catholics, and they hated us, and they were encouraged to hate us because the regimes in that part of the world always blamed all of their problems on us. I mean, it's sort of the same thing that you now hear in the United States. Well, the reason we don't have this, the reason we don't have that, it's those Chinese, you know, it's the same mentality, only now it's the evil Americans, you know, are responsible for everything. Why do we want to feed that? Why not come to some sort of arrangement? I'm told, or at least Zero Hedge published this article, I've heard rumors about it, indicating that Maduro is willing to grant some sort of substantial stake investment from us in his country, in the oil and gas industries. That makes a lot of sense. We have the best oil and gas engineers in the world. Why do we have to invade? Why do we have to have regime change? Well, that seems to be what we've been at for the last, 30 years, repeatedly. It's the same people that brought us strategic disaster in Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, they're behind this as well. That should be enough to scare the dickens out of everybody in the United States. But no one is debating it on the Hill. I don't hear anybody debating anything, just as they failed to debate what we were doing in the Middle East. Now, we can attribute that to the Israeli money that is poured in, or Israeli-backed money, to buy up support. But now we're talking about Venezuela. What are we going to do in Venezuela? How many of these people will make themselves dependent upon us, upon our largesse? How many, what have you got, 2 or 3 million people living in the various cities on the coast? And I'm told that they're looking for food in garbage heaps, that they're raiding trash points to find things to eat. If that's the case, what are they going to demand from us if we enter the country? And then we haven't even begun to discuss those that will resist us. I just don't see any benefit to this sort of thing. It doesn't make any sense to me at all.
Yeah, and again, it seems like you have this belief that you can just compel or physically coerce those to your bend to your will. Unfortunately, we seem to be going down that path. We do have a few more minutes here, and I would like to have your comments on what you think about the new tariff that's been imposed on China, now 100% slapped on top of what was already there, and how that could negatively impact our economic situation. Or do you think that China will budge and give in?
No, China will not give in, and there's no reason why they should. I don't have it with me right now. If I'd known you were going to ask that question, I would have sent you this in advance. But there's a wonderful chart that was presented to me yesterday. And the chart looked at all the major areas of commerce that involved the United States with China. It looked at all the Chinese interests in the United States. And it concluded that in terms of dependency, about 3% of China's economy is in any way, shape, or form linked to us, and is in any way, shape, or form dependent upon us. 3%. Now, if that's all the Chinese have invested in us, what difference does it make what our tariffs say or do? They'll go elsewhere. They're the biggest market in the world now. Everybody knows it. Everybody wants to do business in China. Everybody wants access to their markets. So I don't think the Chinese are going to pay a great deal of attention to us.
Fascinating.
They could certainly cut us off. And we have far greater interest in what the Chinese provide to us than they do in what they provide to us, or what we provide to them. I mean, the bottom line is, you look at this thing with rare earths. This is a disgrace. We've been dependent on these rare earth minerals for a long, long time. You have in Canada a huge cachet. Just go up to Alberta. And there are plenty of rare earths up there that you can get at fairly readily. We have rare earths in this country, but it hasn't been profitable to go after them in most cases. You know, as I discovered down in Kentucky and parts of West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Ohio, the coal seams and this is bituminous coal. The coal seams are full of rare earths, and you can get at those. But we haven't done any of it. You know, why not? Well, we didn't need to. We got it from China. We don't have a refinery. We can't refine the rare earths. What, we ship everything to China, and they refine it, or to Kazakhstan that has a rare earth refinery. This is incredible. And people will come back and say, well, you know, we have environmental restrictions. I'm sure we probably do. But the idea that we are the great power we think we are, and we do not have a refinery, is incomprehensible.
Yeah, totally agree.
And if we're really interested in this, there should be somebody in charge of it across the government that is involved in finding, identifying, and pouring investment in to the extraction of rare earths. Where is it? You know, we become a society where everything is short term. You know, we don't care how much money we're making in 5 years. We want to know what we can make in the next quarter. We're worried about our position today. This is the problem. There is no strategy behind anything. There's no strategy behind Venezuela. There's no strategy behind this peace is broken out all over in the Middle East. There is no strategy behind what's being done in Ukraine. Everything is impulse and short-term driven. It's coming home to roost. And unfortunately, I don't see any evidence that people in this administration are putting together a coherent strategy for anything. It's going to destroy us if we're not careful. The best thing we can do is pull out of these places, shed these unnecessary commitments, and retrench. And your military repurposing this old structure with fewer and fewer and fewer soldiers and sailors and airmen and Marines is not the answer.
No, it's not the answer. And I'm glad you're pointing out those things, because those are too many questions that don't even get asked, much less answered by anybody in this country today. So glad for you to come and provide this very, very clear just analysis of what's going on, and also a prescription for what we can do to fix it. And toward the end, I wonder if you could kind of give us any update on how your conversation in Dallas went there on October 4th, and if there's any hopes to have any additional ones to expand the conversation.
Oh, I think we will do this again. This was the first attempt. The good news is that people that were there are with the exception of very, very few people, are extremely thoughtful and imaginative. And so we're now being flooded with more recommendations, suggestions, and good ideas than we can easily assimilate in a short period of time. But we'll be back, and we'll do something like this again. But we also have to attract more people with an interest in what we want to do. And these are some of the things that you and I and others have discussed in the alternative media. You know, getting out of this business of perpetual conflict that serves the interests of a very small minority of people in Washington and New York City and London, and focus on the United States, not from the standpoint of what can we do next week, but where do we want to be in 5 and 10 years? That's where we need to focus. And we better do it soon, because we've got a lot of problems that will blow up in our face right here at home inside our borders. And I think Americans sense that. I think they know that.
And is there like an email address or something where people can go to maybe get connected to you or get on a mailing list or something so they can be a part of it?
I would go to the nationalconversation.org, to that website. There's an opportunity there for you to express your opinion, and also an opportunity to go there and keep up with where we think we're headed next.
Yeah, we got that address right on the bottom of the screen right there. Yeah, so go to that address right there and put in your information and get connected so you can be part of this conversation, because I'm eager to see where it goes.
And also let us know where you think we should go next. I mean, we're going to go back to Dallas next year, but where are we going to go within the next 12 months? We have to pick some other places to go. And if there are people that have strong feelings and would like us to come to their area and could help us support it, well, then please let us know.
That'll be awesome. Be looking forward to that. Well, thank you very much, Doug. We always appreciate it. And we'll see everybody next time on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.
Thanks, Dan.